Ahoy, Vachon. How's the French say, Vachon? This is the Brown Briefly, where less is more, more or less, coming to you live over KVSH 101.9 FM, Voice of Vachon, your island connection. Please make us part of your day. And be advised that our assertions and views, which can modestly be described as progressive persuasion, do not in any way reflect the opinions of KVSH or Voice of Vachon.
Good morning. Good morning. The welcome to April 6th, 2021. Thank you, briefly, founder Brian Brown. As we continue in your indomitable spirit, we have now arrived on this beautiful day with sun shining on Vachon. If we just pause for a moment, can't we all hear in Brian's classic Irish brogue, just 5 days now into the baseball season, how do you think those Mariners will do this year?
they're going to make a great start, and then they're going to break our hearts like they,
like they always do.
it is a classic scene for sure. Hey, we have some introductions. First, let's recognize island hopping mystic muse, author, and wandering poet, Gail Kellner. Good morning, Gail.
Hi, thank you. Good morning. I want to take a moment after being identified as a poet to share some fun poetry news on the island. And Bruce, add into this, please, after I do. But Mukai Farm and Garden is holding their second annual haiku festival and contest over the next few months there. So if any of our listeners are interested in either reading haikus as they wander through the gardens and the farm, or if they're interested in writing one, there's a fun event where there's a contest, and there for a 17 syllable in the traditional haiku form of 575, and they'll be displayed throughout Mukai Gardens. And the contest will include an award for a heritage award, a nature award, which is the traditional haiku topic, social justice award, young poets, and people's choice. So wandering the gardens, and they'll be displayed in May, is my understanding. And the contest deadline isn't until April 24th, so plenty of time to come up with 17 syllables. So I challenge my briefly to a contest, and as I'm host next week, I can ask for anything. I may not get it, but I can ask. And anyway, if you're interested, listeners, if you're interested in joining in this fun event, you can go to the website www.mukaifarmandgarden.org, all one word.
Wow. And that's only like one syllable a day that the listener has to come up with between now and the deadline. That sounds pretty reasonable.
None of us have an excuse, Kevin.
The problem is which syllable each day.
Is it the syllable?
Syllable, as they used to say, right?
Yeah, the emphasis on the wrong syllable.
And is it the syllables or the order of it does get complicated. I'll give you that for sure. Hey, we also heard there beaming in island historian, storyteller, international educator, and accomplished skipper Bruce Hallman, our stalwart guardian of the galaxy. Good morning, Bruce.
Good morning. That too. I just wanted to let our listeners know about a very special thing that's taking place this Thursday evening at 7 p.m. It's a combined talk, Vachon Lives Well Lived, a joint project of the Vachon Heritage Museum and Vachon Community Care. And this Thursday, we're going to hear about the Vachon Medical Reserve Corps and the response to COVID. And we have four just incredible speakers. Dr. Clayton Olney, who's one of the co-directors of the Vachon Medical Reserve Corps, Dr. Jim Bristow, who led the testing effort, is an epidemiologist, Dr. Ina Opplinger, who has led the vaccination effort, and Dr. Jenna Risdale, who's led the community care team and sort of the mental health side of the Medical Reserve Corps response. And so what we wanted to do is really capture this incredible effort that's been going on for the past year and continues to go on Vashon Island, that has led Vashon to be the highest vaccination rate in King County and the lowest infection rate in King County. So a very significant achievement by a group of volunteers with the Medical Reserve Corps, and of course, Vashon Be Prepared and the Emergency Operations Center, the CERT teams. I mean, it's been a community effort, and there's been probably close to 500-600 people involved volunteering across the board in these efforts. Yeah, Truman.
Yeah, just once again, the time and date, please.
Yeah, it's Thursday evening, so I think that's the 8th at 7 p.m., and you can go to either the Heritage Museum website or the Community Care website, and it's a webinar, so you just need to register for it, and they'll send you a link. We already have about 70 people signed up, so we're expecting a sizable audience for that. Great. And, of course, let me put a pitch in here for Voice of Vashon. Voice of Vashon's own Susan McCabe will be the moderator for this panel.
Oh, cool.
So woohoo!
Great. Very distinguished group of people.
I can tell you that I've been working in the vaccination site, doing traffic control and all of that, and everyone involved has just been spectacular. I just can't tell you how impressed I am with all of the volunteers. They're just amazing. So thanks for that, Bruce.
Yeah, and Ina will tell the story of the whole way that they set up the testing site, the drive-through testing site, and the drive-through vaccination site. Right. Was based on their experience with the Mason Bee.
Oh, is that? Yeah, that's right. I remember.
they developed this whole system of drive-up delivery of Mason Bees. And then when this emergency came up and they needed testing and they needed vaccination, they said, oh, we've done this before.
We knew how to do this. Yeah, brilliant, brilliant.
So it's a great story.
All right, that sort of sounds like we're learning from our flora and fauna friends, but maybe not quite directly. And of course, the news is that we're less than 2 weeks now from every person in the country being eligible to get a vaccine. I understand, I heard on the news this morning that our dear president has said that he's going to make that announcement today, I understand.
Wow, great.
So yeah, moving forward. And through, you did hear the voice of our steely-nerved, steady hand on the Voice of Vashon controls. None of us would be here without Truman O'Brien this morning. How are you doing, Drew?
Good morning. Thank you. Thank you very much. Yeah, steady hand indeed. Steady hand indeed.
Okay, fantastic. Yeah. And you may know that we are missing Lynn Kerrigan this week, but we expect her back next week. So I myself, Kevin Jones, Indivisible Vashon's weekly publication for your consideration. Just one note, the Progressive Vashon podcast on Voice of Vashon tonight at 9 o'clock is going to feature King County Democrat Chair Shasti Conrad and Washington State Democrat Communication Director Will Casey with Indivisible Washington podcast host Stephen Cox. They're going to be discussing the Biden-Harris inauguration and what progressives can look forward to during the Biden administration. Of course, we're 75 or so days into that, but this will be a little retrospective before things started, so you can get out your notepads and sort of compare what they thought we'd see with what we have seen. So that's at 9 o'clock tonight, Voice of Vashon. All right, let's jump into the news. Hey, one thing that I noticed.
Oh, go ahead.
Pardon me.
Go ahead. No, go ahead. Go ahead.
Okay.
I have a bit of news, though, but I'll get to the news when you get to me.
Okay. Yeah. Well, definitely. We have you in our thoughts and plans. So, hey, one thing I noticed: keeping Maury Island Maury, our own Michael Shook, in the March 25th version of the Beachcomber, he proposes in this ongoing debate on Vashon Island about reassigning our own Maury Island to now honor Maury Wills is Michael's proposal. And a number of accomplishments, an artist, a singer, MVP of the National League, broke Ty Cobb's 1915 record for stolen bases in a season. Sounds like a pretty up and up character, wow. a very capable person. Bruce, I'm wondering, you know, there's been a few letters to the editor lately about Maury Island. What do you sense is happening there?
Well, I think, you know, in this sort of era of what some people would characterize as change culture, cancel culture, and woke culture and all that, there's been an ongoing sort of debate about how appropriate it is to name things, military bases, statues, avenues, you know, whatever, after people who were basically traitors to the United States and fought against the United States and fought in to support slavery. And so, you know, in that vein, you know, the I was approached about two and a half years ago by Stephen McDonald, retired epidemiologist here on the island, about the name Maury Island, because Maury Island is named after Lieutenant Maury, who was with the American Exploring Expedition in 1841, and Wilkes named Maury Island after Lieutenant Maury, who then, when the Civil War began, was from Virginia, was a slave owner, resigned his commission, became a captain in the Confederate Navy, actually commanded a Confederate raider that sank a number of and captured a number of Union merchant vessels, and later on was captain of the ironclad South Carolina that defended Charleston Harbor. So here you have a classic example of a military person, part of the exploring expedition, have an island named after him. And of course, Wilkes's whole purpose in naming things was to add to the names, American names, so that America would have a stronger claim to the Puget Sound region. And so the question is it appropriate to have Maury Island named after a Confederate naval officer who fought against the United States and who owned slaves? And I think there's been a number of proposals to rename Maury after a native place name for it, name it after a variety of other Maurys. There's Antonia Maury was a very little known but very famous astronomer who was responsible for developing the star brightness sort of scale that we still use today. So the whole idea is do we pull a King County and rename Maury Island after a different Maury, or do we just leave it as it is?
I was just going to bring that up. King County.
Certainly a controversy.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah, and, hearkening back to Michael, is Michael a former Briefly, or is it that once a Briefly, always a Briefly? What do we all think?
Always. You're branded. Don't you remember the tattoo that you got on your wrist? You
know, I didn't know if we were allowed to tell people about that.
About the BB that's on the wrist.
It's sort of like the song, the Hotel California.
That's
once
right.
You get in, you can check out.
That's right.
There you go. And next time I'm in town, if I see people like looking at my wrist, I'll know.
That's right.
Gail.
I just wanted to ask if any of you know what the native name for Vashon was, because I know Vashon also was named after a lieutenant on that Vancouver's ship, if I'm remembering correctly.
Yeah, actually, Vashon's named after a captain. Later Admiral Vashon that Vancouver served under in the Mediterranean. And what's interesting, out of that group of officers on Vashon's frigate in the Mediterranean were a number of people who came with Vancouver into Puget Sound. Peter Puget himself, a number of other officers, Rainier, Baker, were all part of Vancouver's crew and also served under Vashon. So, The question about native place name, what's interesting is there are place names for specific places on Vashon and on Maury Island. What we've never been able to find, and talking with the Puyallup tribe, what you didn't tend to get is names for large land masses. So the people who lived here considered it home. and they certainly named village sites, and they named Killerware, Mother Rock, and certain things like that, certain geographic features, and features like Lost Lake that figure into various Indian stories or native stories. But what you don't get is a single name for a place like Vashon or like Maury.
Though, am I correct that the Salish Sea is that a is that a European overlay as well? The idea of the Salish Sea?
Yeah, the native people called Puget Sound Wugal, which means water.
Yeah.
So the sort of the great water. There was a Salish name for Puget Sound, but it was a generic name, not, you know. And again, that's, I think, you know, my interpretation at least is, and then talking with the Puyallup tribe about this very subject with Vashon, is that, you know, native people have at that time had a very different sense of ownership and a very different sense of relationship to the land. Europeans tend to name things so we can claim ownership for them. Native people have a different relationship with naming places. So they were usually named after events or after things that happened there or after features like a spring or something like that.
Well, it's like us referring to the Jesus Barn. You know, it's been gone a long time, but all the old timers here know exactly what you're talking about. We go, oh, yeah, you go down by the Jesus Barn. You know what? So it's the same sort of thing, I think. Yeah, hey, exactly. I have two quick news things, if I can throw them out real quick. Just take a moment. Our own Jeff Hoyt, Voice of Vashon's Jeff Hoyt, has done a new podcast, and he's beginning to get back into podcasting now. And this one is being posted today on Apple, Google, Spotify, Stitcher, Deezer. I mean, all of these various pod locations. And I think this one, I think he called it is Cavorting with Calamity. But we played it this morning on our show. And he talks about the marina fire and our little aircraft accident. And anyway, it's very well done. So I would just put that out. And the second bit of news is that we have Susan McCabe has just joined us in the studio. Good morning, Susan.
Good morning, everybody.
Hi, Susan.
So we got one more participant this morning.
A briefly, once a briefly, always a briefly.
That's what we said, yeah.
It's kind of like being a priest, yep.
All right. Fantastic. And Susan, do you have anything you want to say about Real Talk today?
Today, Real Talk is kind of apolitical. I'm actually interviewing a playwright from Los Angeles. Her name is Wendy Graff, and she has written multiple plays that have been produced in the U.S. and throughout the world, mostly about cultural and familial conflict, or how cultural conflict can play out in families. Very interesting, and I'm looking forward to the conversation with her. Thanks for asking.
All right. Yes, fantastic.
And that'll now, be right was... on, right following this, correct?
Well,
following...
15 minutes after this at noon. Yeah, 12 noon Pacific Daylight Time.
Yes, stay tuned. Don't go anywhere. So, hey, there we did hear a mention of a little bit about airplane news, and I'm wondering if tomorrow's Beachcomber front page is going to feature an airplane crash in which two people walked away and lived to tell the story. Truman, what do you know and what are you willing to share?
Well, I believe that it is going to be. We were interviewed yesterday quite extensively, and she was doing it right before going to press. So I think there's going to be quite an extensive article about our little misadventure. And I'm not sure what kind of a photograph it's going to be, but she did take a picture of the two of us while I still had my black eyes, but they're pretty much gone now. You can see I have to tell you folks, Arnica is a wonderful, wonderful product. If you put Arnica on a bruise, it makes it disappear just amazingly quick, even better than CoverGirl, believe me. I mean, it's good. It's good.
Spoken voice of authority.
Yeah. No, I'm telling you, it really works. I think there's going to be quite an extensive article. She wrote a quite a long piece on us, and very, very well done.
You and Craig Bellis, I understand, were on a return flight with a newly painted airplane.
That's where it's going to get confusing. We actually, we didn't intend to do this, but we ended up with two airplanes. It's a long story, but... But we
sounds like a boat story to me.
Yeah, it kind of is. Yeah, it's that, we had that 1-foot-itis. You know, you want one a little bit bigger, a little bit faster. Anyway, we took the new one, new to us, down to Bend, Oregon, to be painted. I flew it down, and Craig flew the our original airplane down to pick me up. And once he picked me up, we were heading back, and we're at 8,000 feet over the Cascades, and engine developed problem. Which we couldn't correct, and it was not developing enough power to sustain flight. and down we came. So we broke out of the base of the clouds at about 5,000 feet and saw a nice big open valley, which we turned into, and it it was full of trees. I mean, majorly full of trees. There was a one very thin, tiny little logging road that we could pick up, but I knew I did not want to try and put it down on that. And so I did see another clearing off to our left, which I also knew I didn't want to land in because, you know, clearings in this part of the world are not clearings. They're full of stumps and logs and everything else. But I did want to get close to it. And my thought was, well, if we get close to it where the trees are a little bit thinner, maybe they'll be able to see us. If we were to put it down in that thick canopy, they would never find us. I mean, virtually never find us. It was so thick. So I turned toward the clearing and then flew it under control as slow as I could fly the airplane into the treetops, and which is training that I've had. It actually slowed the airplane enough to allow it to crash down to the ground, and we walk away from it. So it's pretty amazing.
So I understand this is now, maybe we could call this the miracle on Gumboot Mountain.
yeah, there you go. There you go. I have had a couple of people call me Sully, which is just way beyond the pale. We did everything right. There's no question about that. But believe me, even if you do everything right, there's still a huge element of luck involved. Luck that we didn't hit a big tree head on. And although, actually, we did. They've now recovered the wreckage, and it's over in Kent at a salvage yard, and I've seen photographs of the wreckage now that they've got it out, and there is a major crease in the right front of the engine compartment where we did hit a tree pretty solidly, but it was a pretty wild ride coming down, I can tell you.
And they landed upside down, and he tells his story with such cool and aplomb, and he has every time I've heard it. Mm-hmm. As it happens, there was no requirement for a change of underwear.
No, there really
they
wasn't.
Were both very cool throughout the process and kept their sense of humor.
It was just amazing. Well, should I tell them about the face plant, I guess?
Tell them about the how'd you get the black eyes?
Well, no, I got that just from my glasses, I think. My glasses came out unscathed. My glasses were not even bent. I can't believe it.
Wow.
Black both my eyes, and I had to dig around in the wreckage to find them, but yeah. No, the best part was Craig was able to, after we got ourselves out of our harness and fell down into the wreckage, Craig was able to step out fairly easily, and I came crawling out. I got my left foot hung up, and I finally was able to get it pulled loose, and I squirted out a little bit further out of the wreckage, and I said, now my back's hung up. I can't get my back loose. And Craig goes, I'm holding you by your suspenders. I said, well, let me go. I got to get out of this thing. So he said, okay. And when he did, I fell right on my face in the it was actually dirt. It wasn't mud, but very soft dirt. But I literally buried my face in the dirt. I could not believe it. I raised my face back up, knocked some dirt off, and went, that is not exactly what I meant. But anyway, quite funny, quite funny.
And Craig's hair was always in place.
I swear to you that when I looked up, from having my face plant, I looked up and he's looking down at me laughing, of course, because he knew I wasn't hurt. And I looked up and I said, how in the hell is your hair so perfect? Right. I mean, I'm serious. It looked like he had just stepped out of a studio or something. It was amazing. I don't know how he does it. But so anyway, we've teased him a lot about that. So
Truman, can you tell us about landing the plane upside down?
It really wasn't upside down. We flew it into the trees just as slowly as we could. And by doing that, those smaller branches at the top actually slows the airplane down dramatically. We were at about probably 50 miles an hour when we went into the trees. And those smaller branches do slow the airplane down pretty substantially, obviously. And we ended up pretty much going straight down. I remember seeing the ground coming up as we were coming down. And it really wasn't coming up that fast. I mean, I think we had slowed down tremendously. And then when we hit, we flipped over on our backs. But there was a big log there that caught the left wing and kind of held us up off the ground. So we didn't really smash down into the ground. The engine did. I mean, you can see the front of the engine was smashed into the ground pretty good. And then it kind of flopped over on its back. So that's how we ended up upside down.
Wow. Sorry. our listeners may notice that, you know, last week, Truman, you were gone and Lynn was at the controls.
Yeah,
of Voice Flash on Gene Barr Studio. But Bruce Hallman, our Guardian of the Galaxy, was also gone.
Yeah,
Bruce, were you Bruce? Perhaps prescient in seeing the need to make sure to watch over Craig and Truman on their return flight?
I wish.
Well, somebody had to have been. I thought it might have been you, Bruce. Gosh.
I am the Guardian of the Galaxy.
Exactly, so. Exactly.
Okay, well, I'm certainly glad to hear that whatever guardianship details you're willing to divulge or not, that Truman and Craig are fine. I will have to say that this show would be, of course, very different if the outcome had been otherwise.
Oh,
so
thank
I was
you.
Oh. Tremendously happy that despite the tremendous, must have been adrenaline rush and all your training clearly came through and managed to keep a cool head and steady hands on the controls.
Thank
so
you.
It's wonderful
Thank
to
you.
Hear.
Appreciate that. Thank
I
you.
Will say half the island was holding its breath Monday night from about 7 o'clock until 9:30,
yeah.
waiting to hear whether these two wonderful members of our community were alive and well. And we all breathed a collective sigh of huge relief when we learned they were not only okay, but walked away.
Yeah. I will have to say one more thing. We were picked up by the Navy. Navy search and rescue. They sent down a big PAFOC helicopter, which found us. And those young men were just amazing. I mean, just terrific. They hoisted us up with a cable, you know, out of the clearing. They had to hover. And that helicopter hovered. It looked like it was mounted there. It did not budge. Mm-hmm. I mean, did not move one millimeter. And they picked us up just like zip, zip. I mean, nothing to it. But I will have to tell you one more quick thing. Craig, at the last moment, threw in his cert jacket, you know, the bright yellow and green with the mm-hmm. stripes and all. And when the helicopter first arrived, we had our emergency locator transmitter, so they found us using that signal. But when they first came over, they were there for just, you know, kind of did a very slow flyby. And we flashed our flashlights at them. It was just starting to get dark. We thought, okay, yay, hey, we're saved. You know, they see us, everything's cool. And then the helicopter left, and it was gone. I mean, it just left, and we thought, well, okay, I don't know what that's about. But about 20 minutes, half an hour, they finally came back. And in the meantime, we were making camp. We're getting ready to spend the night, right? Had the seats out of the airplane and everything. We're all set. Had a little fire that we tried to start. Anyway, they came back. And we were waving again at them and flashing our flashlights, and they stayed a little bit longer this time, and then they left. We thought, well, what the heck is going on? And again, about 15 minutes later, they come back this time. They had the spotlights on us. I mean, they lit that whole place up, and, you know, we're again waving. And I said, you know, Craig, I think they're going to pick us up. We better get over to that little bigger clearing that we headed for. And so we did, and we found out later the reason that they left was that they thought we were part of the search crew. Because Craig had this jacket on, even had his badge on the, you know, I mean, his ID on the front of the jacket and everything. They said, oh, that's part of the search party, looking for those guys. And yeah, so they left. Anyway.
Amazing.
Yeah, I thought that was kind of wild. Anyway. All right, on with the show.
Okay, here we go. Thanks so much for the, and I will have to say that one of the news episodes, it was a video from one of the, I don't know which television station, but one of the things I noticed is that they said, yeah, both of the guys were really pretty good spirits. They were laughing and joking.
Yeah,
so,
we were.
Okay.
We were.
Okay. Job well done.
Thank you.
So let's move on to some state news now. And Susie was very excited with an announcement about Initiative King Tim Iman. And apparently just a couple of days ago, he will no longer be allowed to have any financial control over political committees.
Hallelujah.
And as we started to sort of dig into the details here, there was a lawsuit that I guess has been going on for a while. But the summary is that Tim somehow managed to commit more than 100 violations of multiple Washington state campaign finance laws. He failed to disclose a mere $766,000 in campaign contributions. And he took a $308,000 kickback by apparently overpaying a signature gathering firm and then hiring himself as a consultant so that he could be paid that modest sum.
Wow.
Interesting, the law that Ayman was accused of violating was passed by initiative in the state in 1972.
So I guess. the irony.
Any thoughts about Tim Ayman?
That's great. Is he going to go to jail?
You know, I don't know. That's a good question. I haven't seen what the actual penalty is for that. I suspect that certainly the announcement that he won't be able to control any campaign finance was the notable news that we latched onto.
Something.
Gail, go ahead.
Oh, I just wanted to bring up, I don't know either what the penalty will be for him or others that pull these kind of shenanigans. But I'm always fascinated by the inequity between people who commit what we call white collar crimes, and then the rest of us, that it's seems to me a terrible disservice that there should be a two systems of justice. And I kind of think, separate is not equal in this case, in many cases, it's one of those things that I think is, needs to be seriously looked at in a reform status. That if a banker, or someone in politics such as him don't receive punishments that are equivalent and in the equivalent kinds of situations that anyone else would be if they robbed a bank or did something that broke into a house, they would be facing years in prison for these kind of things. And yet these guys can go in your back pocket, around the corner, out of sight, and get away with it. And that, with minimal consequences.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead, Bruce.
Yeah, one of the things I find, and you're right, Gail, I mean, that sort of concept of white collar crime having less severe punishments than other kind of crimes is part of the inequities built into our justice system. They go back to the very founding of our justice system. But one of the things I find a little bit disturbing about the Ayman thing is that it restricts him from being involved with the financial end of political campaigns, but not on the sort of front end or the publicity end of it. So we will probably see Tim Ayman and see Tim Ayman initiatives and that kind of thing well into the future. But his role will be different, and he won't be compensated nearly as well as he has been in the past.
I just found an article about this whole thing with Tim Ayman, and there's two paragraphs, one that lists all of an incomplete list of all of the things that he cannot do. And then there's a further incomplete list of all of the things that he can. And actually, he can do quite a lot more. But again, not he can't be paid unless somebody else makes the decision and yada, yada, yada.
Can he work as a consultant to people who want to do initiatives?
I think he may. I think he actually may.
And he can get paid for that.
Yeah, he said he can continue soliciting contributions for his political work. He must establish a political committee, which will report all the contributions and spending. And if that committee wants to pay him, someone else has to make that decision, not him. And Ayman can have no financial decision-making authority for any political committee, and he must report any payments he receives from anybody unless they specifically have a legal defense fund from an employer that issues a W-2. Anyway, so there's a whole bunch of other stuff that.
So if he's siphoned off hundreds of thousands of dollars for himself, I think the hard part for a prosecutor would be to identify a victim.
Yeah.
Which makes it difficult to convict and sentence a person, I think. But I agree with you completely, Gail. The inequities are glaring. Think about the folks who've been charged with possession of marijuana before it was legal, or with other illegal drugs, who are spending lifetimes in prison. And I don't even like to call it our justice system. I'll just call it our legal system. Mm-hmm. There's not a lot of justice happening.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly. Well, Mr. Iman, it turns out, ran in 2020 for Washington State Governor. This may put a damper on some of his political future ambitions. He did run as a Republican. He claimed similarities between himself and President Donald Trump in terms of style, attitude, and ability to weather attacks from the left. And I thought it was interesting that Tim Iman's middle name is Donald. So, for what it's worth. Let's see. There's other news, of course, national news. Speaking of Republicans behaving badly, Matt Gaetz, our famous, infamous, probably perhaps three-term Florida congressman in one of the most Republican districts in the country. He's also a fan of former President Trump. His middle name is not Donald, though. It's Lewis. But it's not clear that Matt will achieve Donald's high mark of 26 incidents of unwanted sexual contact, but he's still young. He's only 38 years old. What do we think about Mr. Gaetz?
Well, it's interesting. Matt Gaetz represents the congressional district where I grew up in Northwest Florida. So, and I can tell you it's, growing up there in the 1950s into the early 60s before I went away to college, it was still a fully segregated southern, part of basically South Alabama rather than Northwest Florida. And many, although the area's changed and like most places, there's been dramatic changes, and yet still there's some underlying attitudes in that part of the state of Florida that will take a long time to change. And people like Matt Gaetz sort of has a track record, both in terms of racial politics, but also in terms of sexual politics. It's a disgrace.
Yeah, Gail.
Yeah, I would just add in, there's some similarities to what we talked about different justice isn't really blind, in the sense that, if there had been 36 accounts of assault, physical assault from a man to another man, say like they were to hit one another or assault them in some way, you would see a track record of being jailed probably. But to do that to a woman, on the other hand, it's just, well, there, men will be men kind of, boys will be boys sort of attitude towards that. And it's treated with much less seriousness.
Locker room talk. So to
speak. Amen to that. Mm-hmm. And I have not kept up with this case because I find it disgusting. But I did read a headline that linked him to sex trafficking. How serious is that? What do we know about that, if anything?
I think where that goes or comes from is that there were payments made to various people, and that falls into that category of trafficking. I'm not sure that it's really like you're smuggling young girls into, I think it's less than that.
No, you're just selling the homegrown girls.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Well, yeah. Paying them for favors.
Yes, and for favors, right.
Mm-hmm. And underage, under 18, legal age, 17-year-old, I think, is the individual that's been cited in the news. And crossing state lines with some type of remuneration, right? Whether it be plane tickets, dinners, money, what have you. But also the close association Matt Gaetz has with another person whose name I don't recall right now, but is now being quite infamous in terms of a former tax collector, I believe, the job he got hired into. A range of stolen identities for whatever reason, nefarious potentially, but unclear at this point, and facing more than a dozen, I can't remember the number, of charges. But he and Matt were good buddies. And I think on the cable news show that I prefer to watch, there's a great photograph of this other individual, Matt, and Roger Stone. So surprise, surprise.
Joel Greenberg. Joel Greenberg is the guy's name.
That's the one. So, you know, we were talking about justice and equality and inequalities of justice. And the other, of course, national news playing out right in front of us is the Chauvin trial, the accused of murdering George Floyd. The defense, I expect, will start this week. So what's our sense? We see these great dichotomies in terms of how justice is applied. What are our thoughts about the Chauvin trial?
I have a question. I mean, this is something I've thought about. In one of these big high-profile trials like this that are so nationally, you know, noted, I wonder if the jurors take into account what their decision might mean in terms of the response of the community. I really, really wonder about that. Do they think, gosh, if we don't convict this guy, we're going to have a blow up in the community? Or if we do, it's going to be, you know, I'm just curious. What do you guys think about that? Do you think that would weigh on their minds?
I'm not sure they can allow it. They have to make their decision based on the evidence that is presented to them.
Right. I understand. But you've got to be thinking.
I know.
About
how
that.
Can you possibly avoid that that sense of responsibility, and how can you possibly avoid the media? I don't know how they even managed to choose a jury.
Yeah. Well, it's difficult. And I mean, there's a great movie called 12 Angry Men.
Yeah.
And men is because at the time, you know, men tended to dominate the legal system, as they still do in many ways, but it has changed some. But it's a sense of, I mean, juries are social organizations, you know, and you know, juries have social relationships with one another and with their background and with the community they come from. So yeah, I mean, we'd like to think in this sort of perfect world, you know, decisions are made based purely on facts and evidence and those kind of things. I think that's almost impossible for human beings to do that. You do the best you can in trying to weigh, you know, the evidence, but at the same time, there's a larger world at stake. And you look at that in justices, Supreme Court decisions, appeal court decisions over the years, always seem to have relationships with the social system that they exist in, you know, the political and social sort of milieu that's taking place. Brown versus the Board of Education found it totally opposite of what Plessy versus Ferguson found in 1896. And by 1953, the courts had turned 180 degrees. That wasn't based on evidence. Yeah. That was based on social consciousness. So,
yeah. That's kind of what I was wondering.
My read.
I was wondering how much of that is involved, you know.
Well, and didn't the prosecution add the lesser charge of manslaughter to assure essentially that Chauvin will be convicted of something?
Something, yeah.
I think there's three charges, yeah, including that. Mm-hmm. The other factor that they were had been discussed was the civil case resolved, which I believe, if I recall the number, $26 million had been awarded to the George Floyd's family. And I don't know if that number is accurate. I've heard other numbers quoted, but whether that would also influence the jury. So yeah, Truman, I think there's a lot of factors when a case is this visible to the country and the world.
And I just would add that, you know, I think that the outcome of this case is taking the temperature of the country in that way. It's not just like, you know, it is looking at the picture of where we are now, how the Black Lives Matter movement has influenced us all, and how it has hopefully raised consciousness.
May this be a pivot point to a better justice system. Absolutely. All right. Well, don't we hear see Truman the fog lights coming on?
Well, I believe that we do hear a foghorn in the distance, and I guess we'll all be have to gather around the microphone again next week. So thank you much, guys, and we will talk next week.
Good to be with you again.
Bye bye.